no doubt has done more work and maybe even knows more than any one on the staff today regarding the history of the work, because she has put more time into it. And you consider yourself congratulated for having had this privilege. And I have already put in a copy order for Jerry over there a while ago for 50 books. When they come off the press, because I would like to give them to some friends of mine. Would you like to stand up? Why don't you stand up? Okay. Okay, have a seat. This following statement does not hold true for Ms. Skinner or Mr. Bridges. But I have often wondered why I have been asked to speak on history, not just today, but in some of your conferences, you've asked me to give little quips on history from time to time. And it happened so repeatedly, I began to wonder why I was asked. Because I have really never done any extensive study. I put 5 days on this, better part of 5 days, at a motel in Denver. And then it suddenly realized that the reason that I was asked to speak on history, that I was history. So with that introduction, children, we shall launch into the material for today. And Betty has pointed out that chronologically there are 7 years from conversion to Spencer's right arm. Did we ever bury that right arm, or is it, we're going to wait and put it away with less, huh? The one he gave, you know, if he could do those things. And then there's 8 years from Spencer to Pearl Harbor. And then after Pearl Harbor, of course, Dawson was still dividing his time between the boys' work and between the work with the service fellas. Keep in mind this D&M seminar, Dunamis and Martyr seminar, because I feel that in the light of history, this type of thing, this type of research, was the forerunner of much of we have today. And I will bounce back and forth during this period. And if I get excited about some points and decide to quit giving you history and start preaching, you'll have to forgive me, because as I read some of this, my heart was just thrilled beyond words. I was also convicted. For an illustration, some people, I've lost a little weight in the last 5 or 6 years, and some people ask me, how do I do it? And I say, well, I cry a lot at the table. Well, as I did this work, I cried a lot. And I felt like a heel. And of all the things I think that gripped me was the realization that I had spent 10 years with Doss and put so little into practice. When I know some of you and what you're doing, and you'll forgive me, with so little help by comparison, it just thrilled my heart beyond words. And it caused me to give thanks to God for you and to compliment you, of course, but it caused me to be more and more convinced that you can do so much with so little. Therefore, God has committed to us such potent material and principles by which we can reach the world. And those are the things that I got out of this study. And you never will appreciate all history until you do it for yourself. And so put that away when you get retired. Why, maybe you'll be asked to do some of these things as well. From the very outset, the word prayer obedience, or rather word prayer fellowship and outreach. And some things are so funny. 2-3 years ago, we were hashing over the word prayer obedience and witnessing. Were any of you in on that when we were worrying about the wheel? How many was in on that of you? Did you go in through any kind of a study? Do you use obedience or fellowship, Bill?
Fellowship.
Did you ever use obedience?
Well, in the early days.
Yes. All right. And as I, in the outset, it was fellowship. And it was outreach. That's the words I picked up way, way, way back. So then we put obedience, and now we think we've got something really good. We're on fellowship, not realizing we started off with fellowship. We're back where we started from. Doss fed the fellas, as Betty so aptly applied, a very rich diet. His letters, the poems that he used, anything and everything was the richest kind. That was part of his life. He liked milk, and he liked the cream way down. We used to have some Jersey cows here, and he hated to get rid of them because they gave such rich milk. He liked rich milk. He liked steak, great big thick ones, the very richest physical food, because he, being slight of build, could take all that. But so it was in with the fellas. And some of the fellas that God raised up were giants. As we read in Genesis, where the scripture says they were men of renown, they were mighty men in those days. Let me read you a letter from some of the early logs. This fellow is named John Prince. I don't know if John wrote a lot of letters or if he was just a good letter writer, an unusual fellow. I found that he really wasn't such an unusual fellow, that he was an unassuming sort of fellow. You never pick him out of a crowd. But his walk with God and what he wrote was tremendous. And this will give you a picture of some of the forerunners that belong to the outfit that you belong to. This is the USS Philip in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Quote, another incident happened just before leaving St. Thomas, Virgin Islands, for San Juan, Puerto Rico, last Monday. The day before, I was arranging some pocket testaments of John to be given to the natives just before leaving there indefinitely. A fireman came up and asked to see what I had, and a fireman is a Navy man that doesn't have a rate, that works below decks. I never thought I'd be speaking to a group. I had to explain that. I thought I'd better. Wow. We've come a long way. I hope it's up. I gave him one. He promised he'd read it, and he left looking at it. Upon arriving that night on ship, I was praising him and rejoicing in the Spirit. But it was when I started to go the top side and turn in that I heard a splash, and as I ran amidships, I met a man yelling, "Man overboard." I presume that they slept on topside. We used to. He lived down below decks, but in the islands, I'm sure they swung the hammocks up on topside or just spread a blanket up on the main deck where it was a little cooler. So he went up to turn in, and this fellow was yelling, "Man overboard." Down between the two ships moored together, I could see two men. I got down between the two ships somehow, not realizing the danger at the time, for a few waves could have moved the ships together. One yelled at me to get the other man. I tried in vain to find him, but he never came up. We were pulled up very oily. I found out that the other man that didn't come up was the fireman whom I had just given the Gospel of John to that day. What happened was this. I believe God gave this boy his last chance when he read the Mark Gospel that day. But he went ashore and got drunk. Upon returning, he and another drunk got into a fight and fell between the two ships that were moored together. It was a day later when we were in San Juan. The report came that his body was found. They'd even sent divers down under the ships without any results. His death had a real effect on the men. One of the chief petty officers came up to me that night and said, "You ought to convert a lot through this." I told him of the gospel I'd given to the firemen. I used to wonder how I could know what men to talk to, at what time and place. But now I have confidence in his guidance. My job is to take heed to the ministry which I had received in the Lord, and he will guide to the right ones at the right time. John Prince. On the same page, I've noticed it since I copied this, letter from Vic McKinney. Vic went down aboard the Astoria. And this letter would give you somewhat of an idea of Vic's life. This is written from Pearl Harbor. We had a great time out here in Honolulu last week. We had a conference over on the other side of the island at a place named Kokokia. It's a beautiful place and I've ever seen. All that a place should have for comfort, swimming, volleyball, room for baseball and softball and showers. It was a real treat to have Jim Downing here. He gave us a couple of real challenging messages, and Harold gave some good ones too. I asked the Lord to get me up early this morning. We didn't have to get up until 7, but reveille is sounded at 5:30 for the deck force. He woke me up at 5:30, and after asking him to get me up, I did. In my devotions, I considered a verse in Acts 20:26. "Wherefore I take you to record this day that I am pure from the blood of all men." I began to think of the responsibility that was mine on this ship as a witness for Christ. And I have prayed that the Lord would enable me to say that I am pure from the blood of all men. Talking to his chaplain, who now has a church in California where the big marine base is, Oceanside. As far as we know, this was true. Vic was pure from the blood of all men. In other words, he had given the gospel to all those fellows. And so naturally, when I entered the outfit and after Pearl Harbor, meeting some of these fellows, as I shared with my prayer group this morning, my relationship with Christ went almost straight up. You know, you graft your testimony sometime. Mine hit this point, and it didn't go exactly straight up, but it was a tremendous stiff incline. And this was the reason, meeting men who were in such vital fellowship with the Holy Spirit, such as this. So with a few hundred men well-placed, some materials developed with the Collier's article, and conviction and success and personal know-how, why Doss and the work that they call themselves in those days, Christian Navigators, or the Navigators, Christians, were launched into World War II. At the beginning of World War II, thousands, millions, I don't know just how many we had under arms, at the beginning of Pearl Harbor, you see, the conscription had only started, well, less than 2 years previous to that time. Mr. Eisenhower, one of his burdens, of course, in the Louisiana maneuvers in the 40s, was that he'd have to put men into combat, ill-equipped. They had broomsticks and called them guns and trucks and had a big paper sign on the truck saying, "This is a tank." And it broke his heart. He knew what was happening. So we didn't have many men. But I believe at the height of the war, we had some 16 million men and women under arms. So it happened mighty, mighty, mighty fast. With the influx of men, there was a lot of Christians. And such a traumatic experience in the lives of the men, why it was natural to turn to something. And those of you who are military, you know the dramatic difference in civilian life and in military. In military, you don't have to do a whole lot as far as your Christian experience is concerned. Memorize, pray, walk in obedience, and some top sergeant or some gung-ho officer will tell you what to do. And all you have to do is worry about the Lord and meditate on the Word and so on. Civilian life, you know, you got a lot of things to do. Move chairs, rent tables, get the microphone. You know, just myriads of things to do. I imagine, I don't understand how we ever get the gospel out at all with all the stuff that it takes nowadays. But in the fleet or in the service, all you have to do is copy out your verses and take your Bible and proceed. So a lot of the fellas, Christians, having been relieved of these weights which so easily beset us, could give ourselves to the Word of God and spent literally hours and hours a day in the Bible, reading the Bible, memorizing the Bible, talking to people about Jesus. So it was a perfect foundation, it looks to me like, as I read the material, for such a work. And most everything was tried in those days. I don't know most everything. A lot of things were tried. So in case you want to try something, you might want to ask a few questions around. It might have been tried before, and you might have learned. To give you an example, after the war, 1946, the then vice president of the work, a fellow named Harold Chrisman, we had a big home in Oakland, California. As I said, I'll jump back and forth here. He invited a group of us for a study program. Study program would compare, and seminars in those days compared to our training programs now. You got to have different names, you know, as Betty pointed out. I guess it was Lauren last night. You got to have different names for the same things, you know, make them palatable. And we had many of us had been in the fleet for a while, and so Chris decided that we'd have a study program, and we all joined the study program. We didn't know how long it would last, but it lasted 6 months, from January to June 1946. Now, we had been in the Word for some time. Most of us had been Christians all for several years, 3 or 4 years, up to 5 or 6 years, 7 or 8 years. And so we launched into this study program. And it was one of these faith setups. We yet hadn't really launched out on raising money like we do nowadays. So we had to ask the Lord for finances for these 16 to 20 fellas in this study program. And it was kind of a light diet. For instance, we memorized from 10 to 40 verses a week that we had to quote by the end of the week, word perfectly. We did an advanced ABC study every day. We prayed from 1 to 3 hours. I mean praying, we counted on our knees our prayer time. We didn't count coffee break to prayer time. See, every day. And such things like that. It was a wonderful, wonderful time. My. We went through so much of the New Testament that's just so precious to me today. But it was a bit rich, particularly with the intake of the Word. We went through Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and all those small books over there toward the back of the New Testament and part of Revelation. And then we run out of those and come back to some of the longer books in the Gospel and Corinthians. Dawson came in on this thing about halfway through, and he really took us apart. And the reason he took us apart was that we had not taken advantage of how to run a seminar or a study program or a training program from the information that he had. Now this, children, was in 1946, and he was getting after us because we hadn't learned from previously. So in case, you know, you're starting something, ask a few questions. This isn't history, this is a little challenge. Ask a few questions around. There may be reams of stuff in the archives that you don't want to do. And you can just read it. Thus endeth the reading of that. From the start of World War II, right on through to 45 and 46, as I did my study, Dawson was busy. I mean, he was busy. He was continually lining up manpower, buying homes, working with other groups, getting CBMC, I believe Christian Businessmen's Committee goes back, they really got launched, I believe, about 1932 in Chicago. And so this was kind of the early days for those fellas. And he would try to get them to set up a servicemen's center. He'd try to get churches to set up servicemen's centers. Two ladies ran Navigator Homes. He tried to get as many people possible reaching servicemen. In one of the correspondence pieces, there were over 60 servicemen's centers in a fellowship. And he referred to this as the greatest opportunity of all time. Running servicemen centers, the greatest opportunity of all time. This goes along with what Betty mentioned, that what Doss was engaged in at the time was tremendously important. Yet, he didn't move so fast, but what he constantly expounded and preached and taught and pleaded and begged and scolded and exhorted on the things that he knew would make a difference. And although in setting up homes, it seems to me that he put some people in charge who were wonderful Christian folks, but were so ill-equipped to run a home. Now this is, you know, 20/20 hindsight as I'm reading these years subsequently. But it also pointed out to me that Doss was not afraid to take a chance. And I think the reason he wasn't afraid to take a chance is that Doss operated constantly from strength to strength, not from weakness. He was so strong personally. He could carry so many things himself. And therefore, if a person didn't quite pan out like he thought, I'm sure he thought, and he had the burden that, well, I can help them, or we can get someone else to help them. We don't have to wait this long. One of the things that he hammered on, and in quite an article, was the importance of the right helpmate, the importance of the right wife in the work of God, and particularly in the Navigator's work. And I've heard him tell the story about, was it Alice? Louise. Don't call her Alice if her name is Louise, huh? And how the Lord stopped him from this. One time, Lila was sick. And I don't know where I was living at the time, but I knew, know where I was standing. The address of the Nav home was 509 Monterey Road in South Pasadena. And it was a big driveway in. And we were waiting for the rest of the gang to come to the car or something. Doss was always waiting for people to load up, you know. He was ahead of time. And if you could find that out, you could scoot out there and get a little time with him. So we were chatting there, and he said, Johnny, he said, we want to pray for Lila. He said, you know, if we lost her, we'd lose an awful lot to the work. Now, this flipped me completely because he used the word we. He and I lost her. It was his wife, you know. And but he was speaking of something more than a wife. He was speaking of him and me and in the great work of God, you see. Here I was, a little old guy that fouled up completely, and he included me, you know. If we, and he says, you know, he says, if it hadn't have been for Lila, there wouldn't have been a Navigator's work. I've told this two or three times in front of Lila. She's always embarrassed, but that is a quote. That is what he said. Materials were very important to Doss. Even though he was moving fast and even developing materials during the war years, they were tremendously important. And he knew the value of the right materials. And he wasn't afraid to use other people's materials, as has been mentioned. One of his illustrations that I've heard several times was the old doctor in the poor tools versus the young doctor in the elaborate hospital, you know. And he'd ask the question, if you were going to have an appendectomy, would you rather have an old, experienced doctor on the kitchen table with some tools, with hot water for sterilization and so on, or would you like to go to the latest hospital with all the equipment with a young intern that had never even observed an appendectomy? Well, of course, we always came to the altar on that one. And voted for the old doctor, in case you missed it. In 54, you remember the Haringey meetings in London, and 3,000 people came forward. And the people that were in charge of the counseling had the beginning with Christ. It would change from B-rations, Bible-rations, to beginning with Christ. And they came up to Mr. Trotman, "Mr. Trotman, Mr. Trotman, we're out of materials." And he says, "Relax." He says, "They probably ran out of materials at Pentecost." You know, 3,000 there came for as well. And so although he put a lot of stock on materials, he realized that a lot of Christians before his time and subsequently have been just reared on the Bible. In fact, many Christians become strong never having heard of the work of the Navigators. And Doss knew that. Incidentally, a little picture of Dawson's life, whereby I've made application, was in London. The British in 1954 had all the rations that they wanted. It had rations long before we did, before World War II and long after. And they didn't like rations. They didn't like the word. And so Dawson was willing to change the name, beginning with Christ, comparing to the name of, as it is on the Spanish, beginning with Christ. And so virtually all it was changing the outside cover. So we got word back here to change the cover and reprint. And here's a little sermon I'll throw in all due respect to those of us. You know, sometimes we hear an expression, old and set in your ways. Well, that could be true. But you know, you can be young and set in your ways. And I think Dawson changed his ways as I watched him grow. And I hope I'm changing mine, willing to change. It was so precious to him. But he changed it because he was motivated to a greater job of getting people to memorize the verses, not holding on to his particular name, you know. I've got this package in different packages, and over here I didn't know how to put a bunch of stuff, so I just listed them one through so many things that I remember about Doss, or things that I've picked up in reading about Doss. I may or may not use them, but that was one of the things anyway that he was willing to change. As far as grouping in years, 41 to 46 would perhaps be a group of years, 46 to 48, and 48 to say 52 or 53 are up until Glen Eyre. 41 to 46 was managing a movement that God had prepared built on the work of these men. I don't know what 46 or to 48. Quiet years, although they really weren't quiet. Boy, it roared like a storm. But they, as you read back, it seemed like it was kind of quiet. The girls' work started in San Francisco under the leadership of Marge Gould, Bill Gould's wife. Bill was at sea, and the Lord laid reaching out in more or less of an official way on Marge's heart. And this was just the beginning, and it's taken many forms since then. I won't have a whole lot to say on that, except to mention that Dawson, although he put his major strokes with young men, all through his life, women have had a tremendous influence. Miss Mills and Miss Thomas, and his own dear wife, Lila, and his mother, and the emphasis on the staff and his relationship to the girls on the staff, a very, very high regard, high priority, a gentleman in every sense of the word, much praise. And although in those early days and in even in latter days, in some respects, with those who were close to him, his training was rough on both fellows and girls. He really had a knack to me of making ladies feel like the queens that they really are. And although Doss was busy during the war years, he kept up with the fellows who were already overseas. And he had a knack of keeping abreast of all that was going on and of keeping the gang informed. An illustration, after we'd gotten Glen Eyrie and after Doug and Leela had been overseas for some time, Doug returned home and we planned a big celebration for them. And we all met Doug and Leela at the gate with horses and all the fanfare and whatever the costumes were those days and so on. And the training program here at the time, hi Doug, hi Leela, hi Doug, hi Leela, hi Doug, hi Leela. And Doug took me aside and he said, John, I don't know these people. I haven't met these folks. They're saying, hi Doug, hi Leela. I said, I know you don't, Doug, but they know you. I said, because Doss, as always, has kept every one of these kids abreast of what you've been doing. So you just assume that they know you and that you know them. And, you know, try to call them by their name because they know all about what you've been doing. And to me, that was such a tremendous thing. And I, of course, tried to make application of that to my own life. One point I want to mention here, that many things it seems that Doss floated into, it just inherited. But lots of things came from careful planning, careful prayer, careful observation. For instance, the work with officers. This was on his heart long before this opened up. The work into the army. This was on his heart long before it opened up. So when it came, it was ready. And moving into other cities, I was amazed at how thrilled they were, the inner core, of moving from Los Angeles and opening up the work in San Diego. It's only, you know, an hour and 15, 20 minutes down from Los Angeles to San Diego, wherever you want to put Los Angeles city limits now, maybe only 30 minutes. But in those days, it was a tremendous thing. And it's hard to grasp that when you realize that Leroy Iams had a half-day conference here Saturday with 1,047 people, you know. And you are in areas and contact points, and you get a fellow going over here at 100 miles away or 200 miles away or 400 miles away if you're up in Oregon, Idaho area. And it doesn't seem much to you. But in those days, getting something started, even as far away as San Diego, was a tremendous thing. By 1944, I noticed such statements began to creep into Dawson's writings as he wrote to the fellas and others. He began to make such statements as, the battle gets worse. I remember hearing him on his 40th birthday say, gang, hit it hard when you're young. I'm 50 now. In fact, I was 50 yesterday. And the day before that, and the day before that, and the day before that. I just learned that one this week, so I thought it should be. Even this feels kind of strange to me to hear, to read about, and to remember that Dawes said, hit it hard when you're young. It even get harder at 40, and I'm 10 years beyond 40, you see. Of course, in 1944 and 1945, somewheres along here, Dawson prayed that the Lord would bring things into his life that would mature his life and mellow his life. Two of the things that Dawson brought into his life was the birth of a little son, Chucky. And he had a lot on his heart for Chucky, and he mentioned some verses that God had given him regarding Chucky. Then only to find that Chucky would never be able to recognize anyone. Chucky lived to be about 14 or 15 years old, having the mind of a very small child, never being able to recognize anybody. And Dawson used to go into his room and he'd talk to Chuck. Of course, Chuck couldn't talk back or even respond. And he'd tell Chuck, you know, how much he loved him. And he'd mention to Chuck that they couldn't fellowship until they got there at his feet. Of course, they've been fellowshipping these years now, I guess. And this melody. Another thing that happened was one of the key fellas was used of the enemy. God turned it to his glory to split the work. And this was such a tremendous man. I met him for a short while. This man had a keen intellect. When I knew the man, he knew over 700 proverbs he could quote. Proverbs, not Isaiah or New Testament, just proverbs. He was also a tremendous man of stamina and of drive, handsome fella, weighed about 165 pounds, tall. He was a boxer in his early days. He had so much fortitude he could drive himself to tremendous lengths. He was absolutely fearless. In all due respect to our brother Lee, who is our pace setter and witnessing and taking on hard jobs, I think Leroy could even learn from this fellow. Because I've seen him talk to the most loud-mouthed, boisterous cussing fellas and walk right up to them and take them on. Tell them about Jesus and quote the word. In his boxing days, he was sick one time. And he had an operation in his stomach, and he couldn't get up and exercise. But he'd slip down on the end of the bed and move his feet like this and exercise. And he developed the muscles in his stomach. They were so tough that the doctors had a rough time in the operation, cutting through the walls of the muscles of his stomach. And he couldn't walk, but he had this much grit. He developed a right hook, and he'd warm up in his boxing. He told me this. And he'd hit the punching bag so hard he'd rip the muscles in his back and let them grow back and warm up, and weeks and months later, whatever, I don't know, I never boxed. I always ran. I'm better at track. And then he'd tear these muscles again and again. And he developed such a hook. He was boxing with a fellow one day and he hit him so hard he thought he killed him. He did almost kill him. And he decided that he better quit boxing because this didn't glorify God, killing people like that. This was the fella. So you can see what kind of leadership he had, you see. This was the fella that was used to write letters to others and draw them in, and many things they accused Doss of sins in his life. One of the letters that were written to one of the Christian leaders was written to Dr. Fuller, Dr. Charlie Fuller. The now Dr. Fuller, Dr. Dan Fuller, a few years younger than I am, and I were talking about this during those days or shortly after. And he said that the letter had come to Dad, and Dad and Doss had talked about it. And Dad, Dr. Fuller, Dr. Charlie, said, "Doss, there's no use for us to talk about this list of sins." He says, "This list isn't complete." So Dr. Fuller was so far above that, he wouldn't talk about partial list of sins, you know, knowing that the blood of Jesus Christ cleanses us from all sin. So Dr. Fuller was a tremendous encouragement to them. It seems that problems always face Doss. It was plague. 1945, latter part of the war, he felt he should go to Honolulu. I don't know, perhaps it was in regard to this problem. But I was in Oakland before he left, and I was there at a rally when he returned. And in reading back and in my own memory, I'll read you a paragraph here from Hawaii that Doss wrote sometime. "Our God is in the heavens. He hath done whatsoever he hath pleased. The trip to the islands is now victory. Business was done for eternity. Time and space now, however, will not permit an account of the trip, so this letter will be followed very soon by another V-mail taken up particularly entirely with the Honolulu trip. It was the most gratifying to see the fellows accept with open hearts the exhortation and challenge to the one big job before the navigators. Two, produce reproducers." And this was the first time I saw this in writing, or the first time I remember it was after the Honolulu trip. "To produce reproducers." He was there on the islands, and I believe that there were some seven major Bible studies going, taught by seven men, and they were giving the gospel seven nights a week. And Dawson said, "Are you spending time with any key fellows to take your place?" They said, "No, Doss. We're preaching to men who go into the front to die. This is their last chance." He says, "Who's going to preach to them when you go to the front?" In other words, when they went to the front, the Bible study or the preaching would quit because there's no preaching. See, that was Dawson's mind along this time. And so he says, "Why don't you take one night a week or sometime a week to train a man so that he can go to the front and preach, or he can relieve you when you go to the front and preach?" And in those days, he began to push real hard, along with follow-up, on, "Have you left someone in charge? Have you left one man in charge? Who?" And their chin would put up. "Who, because of you, is carrying on the gospel of Jesus Christ?" In other words, because of your life, not anyone else's. "Who, because of you?" And he'd squint those eyes and those big bushy eyebrows, and you'd wonder, "Now, I am saved." Now, I never heard such nothing like this in all my life. I never heard such a thing in all my life. See? I could have been persuaded I wasn't converted. You know, if I had another altar call, I'd have gone, what it was. After World War II, so many of the fellas got out of the service. Getting out of the service, there was a lot of adjustments. I think I'll quit right here with one statement. As I was making notes, I went through and read and make a statement, just numbered them. One through whatever it was, and I just write a statement. And as I was going back through and putting it all together, one statement kept coming out that I'd written down, and I didn't intend it this way. "We've lost a lot of men from the battle." Not from the navigators. A lot of fellows have transferred from the navigators, but we've lost a lot of men from the battle. So I want to throw that in along with others. We do have 2 or 3 minutes. I wonder if you have any questions on thus far that you'd like to ask. Yes. Maybe I could it a little bit later. I think it takes just a little bit too long, and I don't want to give it a... I'll take it now. I don't want to give it too long. Just thought of that. I don't know why. I really don't know why. But I do know the effect that it's had on me, Bruce. The effect that it's had on me as I've gone through the material is that there are lots of things that can cause a person to quit the fight. And I'm not talking about evangelism per se. I'm talking about living for Jesus and outreach and that God has called us to. There's a lots of things. And having made this notation in my notes, then I began to see in Dawson's writing and letters and other places how he warned against letting anything come in that would cause us, that would be the beginning of turning aside from following him. So that's the application that I derive from it. Though it be bitterness, though it be overt sin, so it be a secret sin, though it be a spiritual sin, as I remember now, and as I've gone over it these last few days, he did preach a lot on maintaining a life. And words that I saw that we don't use much now, the word sharp, pure, and clean. We use the word sharp quite a bit, but we don't use the word pure and clean now that was used then. And I'm sure he had a reason for using those words. Any other questions? No other questions? Well, Jerry, I think perhaps the things that might want to be of interest, you know, there's so much here, but perhaps take a few minutes later at a later time on just some list of things that are not listed chronologically in regard to Dawson's life that I read and picked up, and just a list of them. Some are amusing and some are not, and some might have may have fusion, some are not.
Why don't you take tomorrow morning time with you, give me
the annual. Okay. All right.
We'll do that.
Thank you.